Hey everyone, this is Chris Hall and you're listening to the Downtime Podcast, where we delve deep into the gravity-based side of mountain biking. This week, the podcast is supported by Leia and Abbey Bike Tools. You may be familiar with Leia from their neck braces, and in fact, we've got an episode in the back catalogue with Chris Leia talking in detail about those. Leia are now a head-to-toe company and provide everything from helmets and braces through protection and apparel to riding shoes. I've been using some of their kit over the last few weeks and I've been really impressed. This week, I want to mention their Airflex Pro knee guards. They're a soft shell guard, so not as protective as a hard shell, but if you're looking for something you can pedal in, then these are an absolute winner. I've tried a number of soft shell pads, but never found anything that is this comfortable. Other than adding a little warmth, I literally forget they're on. They're easy to put on too and don't slip down when you're riding, so these are my new go-to knee pad. You can check out everything Leia has to offer over leia.com. That's leatt.com. If you want to be in with a chance of winning a pair of their new Aaron Chase signature shoes, then all you need to do is to head to leia.com/ACshoe and fill in your email address there. Don't worry, you don't have to join a newsletter or a mailing list or anything like that. You've got until the end of July to get that done to be in with a chance to win. All the links you need are in the show notes for this episode over on downtimepodcast.com. Also, thanks to Abbey Bike Tools for supporting this episode. Abbey Bike Tools are making top quality precision tools specifically designed for the needs of the bike world. And as a result, you'll see them as the tool company of choice in many of the top mechanics' toolkits. Aaron Gwynn's mechanic John Hall is a big fan, and that's obviously speaks volumes for just how good these tools are. They've got a wide range of tools available over at abbeybiketools.com. And what's even better is that they have a couple of full toolbox options available too. So if you've ever drawled over those amazing World Cup mechanics toolboxes with the cut foam inserts, the pull-out trays, and the amazing layouts with all the tools that you need, then this is your chance to own a toolbox just like that. If you want the best quality precision tools to look after your bike, then abbeybiketools.com is the place to head. Thanks to everyone who's bought one of my new t-shirts. The response has been amazing. If you want to help support the podcast too, then head over to my web store now and check out the new range. They're all made of super soft 100% organic cotton. They're a really great fit and are made using renewable energy too. So if you want to represent and help the podcast at the same time, then you can head to downtimepodcast.com/shop now and check them out. If you're not yet subscribed to the podcast, then get it done to make sure you never miss an episode. It's free and it's super simple to do. Just head to downtimepodcast.com/subscribe and click the button for whichever platform is best for you. While you're there, you'll find a form where you can sign up for my newsletter, which means you'll get an email most Fridays about exciting bike stuff that I've seen throughout the week. Something to get you stoked for riding at the weekend. Okay, this week's episode is also supported by Motion Instruments, and we're going to be finding out more about mountain bike data acquisition with one of their founders, Rob Shakuski. Rob is responsible for the system that Greg Minar uses on his bike, so you know that it's going to be good. I sat down to chat with Rob about his background in bikes and businesses, and to find out how he went from being a product manager in a data storage firm to setting up Motion Instruments in order to create accessible data acquisition kits to help us set up our suspension and get the most from our bikes. Find out what it takes to get something like this off the ground, how Greg Minar got involved and disrupted the direction of the project, and hear about some of the significant challenges along the way. Rob's story is a real inspiration for anyone who's not loving their day job and wants to change things up and follow their passion. So, without further ado, here's Rob Shakuski. Rob Shakuski, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. How's things with you?
Oh, they're going great. Thanks for having me.
Ah, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. So let's start from the beginning then and tell us a little bit about how bikes in general came into your life.
Yeah, I think my earliest recollection of, bicycles was, just learning how to ride one. And it was like an old, Schwinn with the banana seat, big handlebars. And I just remember getting pushed by my neighbor, rolling on the street and rolling into a ditch and, kind of getting hurt. But I don't think I was really, passionate about bikes until it was probably like 75, 76, some high school kid came by on a dirt bike, and it was, I'll never forget. It was a Suzuki, dirt bike. And, he rode a wheelie down the street. And I just thought that was the coolest thing ever. And pretty much from that day on, I was into bikes and, trying to mimic, motorcycles. And, I just thought, anything on two wheels was the best thing on the planet. So.
Yeah. And were your parents keen on you having a motorbike?
No. Not at all.
Yeah. Okay. So it was a pedal based bike for a while then.
Yeah, it was a pedal-based bike. I mean, I was just kind of, I just remember just wanting to build big jumps on my bike. And I think I was the only one in the neighborhood that was doing all this crazy stuff. And then, you know, in the late 70s, early 80s, the BMX thing had just kind of started, and kind of where I grew up, it wasn't a big thing, but I kind of, you know, begged my dad to go buy me a BMX bike, which was, you know, probably, it was in the big city about 40 miles from where I lived. And we ended up buying a CW ZX Pro, and I started racing, you know, way back when. I was like 11 years old. But yeah, that whole BMX thing was a really fun time to be alive back then.
Yeah, cool. Did you get quite competitive at it?
You know, like I said, we were kind of locked in the farmland, so it wasn't like I had a track close by. I mean, I just had this fantasy of, you know, living in California where the BMX thing was really big at the time. But yeah, where I lived, it really wasn't a big thing. So I, you know, whenever I could beg my dad to drive me to the BMX track, I'd go race. But, you know, it's not like I wasn't on a plan to, you know, go to the Olympics or anything. It was just kind of, that was just what I wanted to do with my time.
Yeah. Something for a bit of fun, a bit of a hobby.
Yeah.
You know, and how about mountain biking then? When did that kind of find its way into your life? Cause did motorbikes kind of fit in the gap there?
Yeah, well, it's funny. In high school, I ended up buying a motorcycle because I got a job, and my parents never knew I had the motorcycle. I kept it at my friend's house, and I'd go over there after school and work on it and stuff. So I kind of had a dirt bike in high school that my parents never really knew about. So I was riding that. And then when I turned 18, I started racing motorcycles off-road, just kind of enduro. Did that for a few years. But the mountain bike thing kind of came into my life. Yeah, I would say it was 91, 92 when I went back into college. And I just started, you know, I got a GT RTS1. If you remember that bike.
Yeah, I do. Very well.
It was a terrible bike. You know, all the things you learn about bikes today with anti-squat, anti-rise, it was the exact opposite. Because every time you pedaled that bike, your seat would raise about, you know, 2 inches. And yeah, under braking, there was no anti-squat. So it was, you know, it was like the bike that you would use to teach people not how to design a bike. But it was a cool looking bike. And, you know, it was one of the first full suspension bikes kind of out there. So.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I would have, killed for one of those when I was younger. So.
Oh, it was a great bike. And then I ended up selling it as fast as I could. I sold the frame and fork and kept the parts and put it on one of the old Cannondale F frames. So it had the, you know, the fatty head shock, and, you know, it was a hardtail aluminum, but it was a great bike. You could pretty much bomb down anything with that bike.
Awesome. And at what point did you start kind of playing about with the suspension? Because those early bikes, there wasn't really much adjustability, was there?
You know, my first, you know, foray into suspension was just getting my dirt bike set up. I mean, I set my suspension to Pro Circuit at the time. This was like in the, 89, 90, that kind of, it was a long time ago. But I just remember when I got that suspension back, it was a major difference. But I couldn't tell you what they did. I ended up taking it apart and noticed they, you know, welded a couple holes shut and drilled a couple more. And this is way back when, you know, kind of open bath kind of forks, you know, very simple. But boy, it made a big difference. And from that point on, I was pretty convinced that, you know, suspension is a big deal because it just improved the bike so much.
And what about on the mountain bike side of things then? Did you start tinkering with mountain bike suspension too?
Not really. I'll tell you, I got out of, so I was pretty heavy into mountain bikes until around 2002. And then when I met my wife, she was in a triathlon. So we ended up doing triathlon for about 5 years. And I was just kind of doing a lot of road biking and running and swimming. I just took a few years off of the mountain bike. And then when I got back into it, many years later, I got a Specialized enduro. It was a 2015. And I just remember it was a really complicated bike to set up. And it was one of those things where, you'd get the fork working, and then you know, you would mess up a shock and vice versa. So I really didn't know what I was doing. I was just trying to get the thing dialed in, but I just noticed, yeah, there's a lot of settings and pretty confusing. And before that, I had a KTM 450 that I was trying to, you know, figure out some, how to eliminate some stutter bumps, this really harsh feeling in the forks. And, you know, I tried everything from changing the oil viscosity to oil height to, you know, different springs and settings. And, you know, I finally ended up working it out, but I just thought, man, it would have been nice if I had some data to help me figure this out. Cause as an engineer, I'm using all kinds of things to diagnose electronics, and yeah, it'd be great if I had something for the suspension. So that's kind of where it started.
Okay. So in the background then, alongside your love for two wheels and tinkering about with suspension, what's happening kind of education and career wise?
Yeah, education. So I kind of went back to school later, about 4 years after I graduated high school. So I ended up getting a electrical engineering degree, and I was working construction before that. So when I went and talked to the counselor, they were like, you know, you should pick something a little easier. And I'm like, no, I don't want to read a lot of books. I just kind of, I'm good at math. I can, you know, get my, you know, self through that. But I could never be a lawyer or a doctor or anything that requires lots and lots and lots of reading. So I ended up choosing that, as a field of study. And then I graduated, moved to Silicon Valley, and around 97, I ended up, working in defense for a couple of years, designing systems for surveillance. And then I, was an electronics engineer for, storage area network switching products, designed a bunch of switches and that kind of stuff for a few years. And then I went into product management, which is, kind of more of like a business role, but it's very technical. It's kind of, you know, it's, you're the leader of a product basically. So it's kind of like a mini CEO position where, you know, you set pricing, strategy, the market, and then you figure out what to build for that market. So I did that for data storage for, gosh, probably 10 years.
Yeah. And then you were quite high up.
Yeah. I mean, I was, you know, senior director level. But I, you know, it's funny because I never really saw myself being successful in that role. I just didn't, you know, I wasn't really passionate about the technology. And I'm kind of a person where, you know, if I like something, I'll go all in and, you know, put the effort in. But I just never really, I don't know, I just didn't really put that much of an effort into that career. And I ended up, you know, just kind of regretting it. And it was funny, one day I was at my computer desk at, you know, during lunchtime, and I had two computer screens in front of me. And I decided to put up the helmet cam videos of Johnny Walker and Graham Jarvis at the Erzberg the year that Johnny Walker won the race. And so I kind of synced them up and hit play at the same time. And it was, you could actually see them racing each other on the start line. I ended up watching the whole race. And after I got done, I just said, man, I need to get the heck out of this job. there's got to be something better in life to be working on than, you know, storage area network stuff for, you know, enterprise. And that was kind of where I said, I've got to figure something out. And that's kind of how I thought of, you know, it was kind of right then where I thought of this idea for doing this suspension thing.
Yeah. So how did you decide on your exit plan then? You've made the decision you want to get out. How do you go from there to actually kind of putting something into practice? Because I think there's plenty of people that will be listening to this that are thinking, that sounds familiar. I often stare out the window and wish I was doing something else, but actually going and doing it is very hard, right?
It is. And, you know, from the point of where I had the idea, I mean, I was, you know, it's kind of like when people have an idea on something, they get really excited about it and they, you know, want to do a bunch of work on it, but then usually they fizzle out and they just say, well, it's too hard, I can't do it. And so the way I did it is I ended up writing like a 30-page kind of technical paper on how I would architect the system. And then I spent the next 4 years just looking for somebody to help me write some software. And, you know, in Silicon Valley, like everybody's either working at Facebook or Google, they're making so much money that they just say, it's just, I can't take the risk of doing something from scratch. And it's a neat idea, but you know, it's not for me. And so I just kept on looking. And at the time I really wasn't ready to jump out full time on this thing anyway. It was just, I didn't have the money in the bank and the reserves to do that. So I ended up getting another job in the storage market. And it was a company started by Andy Bechtolsheim. So Andy Bechtolsheim started Sun Microsystems. He was the first investor in Google. You know, he's had a huge career. You know, he's a billionaire here in the Valley. And he had this small little startup called DSSD. And I ended up joining that thing. And EMC ended up buying that thing for like $1.2 billion. And so, you know, and that was pre-revenue. So they, you know, they saw a lot of, you know, value in that product. So they bought it for this, you know, so I made some money on that. I wasn't at that acquisition, but I came in very early after that. And okay. Then, so they gave, you know, so I was basically working for EMC, but through this little startup called DSSD, and they just gave a really, really good stock package. And then, Dell ended up buying EMC. I vested all that stock, and then they gave us a bunch more stock. And some brilliant person at my company, and I don't know who this is, but if I find him, I'd love to give him a big old hug. They put a provision in there that said, if they end up shutting down that division, all of our stock gets vested again. So like in a span of, I don't know, 18 months, I had two pretty good stock grants, and then I got laid off. And with a really nice layoff package. So that was my, you know, now I had the money in the bank to start this company. And then miraculously, like about 3 weeks before that happened, I was looking on LinkedIn and I saw a post from an old software guy that I used to work with 20 years ago saying he was working on IoT stuff. And I was like, oh my God, this guy is the best software guy I ever worked with. And I, you know, didn't think I'd ever, you know, work with this guy again. So I just called him out of the blue and said, hey, are you free to work on something? And sent him that 30-page white paper. And about 2 weeks later, he was like, yeah, let's start working on it.
Amazing. What, you'll have to explain what IoT is.
Oh, it's short for Internet of Things. So this was, you know, a few years ago, that was like the rage and everybody thought they're going to put their, you know, their toaster on the internet and their refrigerators. But really it's just, a suite of really powerful, low-cost processors that usually have a Bluetooth or ANT interface for radio that you can connect to and control a device.
Okay, so this is the key to your system is that connection between the hardware on the bike and the phone as the data logger, I guess.
Yes. Yep.
Got it. Okay. So you've got this guy willing to come on board and help out with that side of things. Where do you go from there?
So we just said, okay, we got to get a you know, kind of a cheap prototype. And so I was working with my friend Randy. He's a mechanical engineer, and he had I had the idea of using these really low cost, they're pressure sensitive resistors that you can just kind of tape on a surface, and then you know, you can put your finger on them and you can see the movement. And so we ended up using one of those. And his first iteration of the product was, it was a curtain rod bent 90 degrees. And we taped, you know, basically put that on the fork and then taped on the membrane. And he, you know, had a little 3D printed thing that he was using as an actuator to put pressure on the resistor. So we had that on my bike. And then we just ended up taking a development kit from Texas Instruments and, you know, writing software to that and then feeding that with like it was a USB battery. So picture like a, you know, 5x3-inch box on my handlebars with a USB battery taped to it with a long wire going onto my fork. It was ugly, but it kind of worked. And it took Mike quite a while to get some software written to actually get, you know, data from the fork to the phone. Like it was an awful, awful process to the point where Mike was going to quit because the tools that were developed by Texas Instruments were just horrendous to say the least. But yeah, we kind of pushed through that and, you know, got a basic prototype working probably about 6 weeks after that, after Mike joined.
Amazing. That must have felt pretty good to get the first piece of data from the bike onto the phone.
Yeah. I mean, it was, I've got some old pictures of that somewhere, but yeah, it was, and the prototype lasted about, I don't know, probably 20 minutes and then it just kind of vibrated apart. But we did get some data and it was kind of cool to see, yeah, I think we can, you know, make this work. So it was kind of the start.
Yeah. And at that point, did you have a feel for the kind of the market? Like, did you know that people would want this?
Yeah. I mean, I just figured I need this product. So if I need it, then there's probably other people like me that need it. And the barrier to the market was a bunch of really crappy products that were, you know, it looks like they were designed in the 80s or 90s, that, you know, required laptops and cables and they weren't cheap. They're like, you know, $3,000 to $5,000. And so that's not going to work. So we just had to come up with a system that was much cheaper and, you know, and solved a bunch of the problems that they didn't solve. And I think we'd have a market.
Yeah. At what point did Greg Minnar get involved in this picture? Because he tested one of the fairly early prototypes.
Yeah. So he, it's funny. So I had that monstrosity on my bike and I was at my local bike shop and the guy who owned the bike shop this is the Woodside bike shop in Redwood City. The guy who owns it, his name is Greg. He grew up with Rob Roskopf. So he was really good friends with Rob at Santa Cruz. And he just said, "Hey, you should talk to Greg Minnar. This is something that he would be into." And at the time I was like, yeah, hook me up with Greg. But I didn't think I'd ever, you know, hear from this dude. And, you know, so he sent him an email and sure enough, like 3 weeks later, he says, "Hey, I'll be in the Bay Area and we should meet up." And so, yeah, it was basically the weekend that we had incorporated the company. We signed all the paperwork for the three founders. We were up at Donnyville that weekend, and that's where we signed our incorporation papers. And then I drove down to the Bay Area and met Greg in Saratoga. We just had a nice chat for about an hour. And it was kind of the catalyst for us to actually make a prototype that didn't look like crap too. So then we spent about 6 weeks, putting together kind of an integrated design with the circuit board and the sensor, and it was all kind of nice hardware that could attach to your fork. And, you know, at the time we were thinking, we'll use the accelerometer in the circuit board and we'll measure position. And we just thought we were going to make a fork sensor. And then Greg took a look at it and he was like, "Yeah, this is really interesting, but, like, you know, this fork thing is not going to do anything for me. You're going to have to make a system for the front and rear." And so he kind of basically crapped all over the idea, which was kind of good. You want to fail fast. But he just said, "Yeah, if you can't get balance for me and figure that out, then this isn't going to be a system that anybody in the World Cup's going to use."
Okay. That's a big change of direction for you guys then, really.
Well, yeah. So there was a bunch of unknowns. We didn't know if we could get multiple sensors streaming data to the phone at the same time. We didn't know if we could keep those signals synchronized, you know, and then there's just so much we didn't know. We didn't know if the phone could sustain the data rate from all those sensors. And so we just had to basically refactor all the software to handle multiple sensors and then design the app to be much more fungible. And then we had to figure out bike balance, which took us about a year and a half just to figure that out. And, you know, wasn't like there's any books on this stuff when we started the company. So.
For sure. So yeah, talk us through then. What is it you're actually measuring first?
So we're measuring the position of a fork or a shock. We sample that today it's at 200 Hertz. So that's 200 times a second. We're sampling the position and then streaming that data to the phone. And on the fork, we're also getting vibration data as well. So we're basically, you know, quantifying how much vibration is reaching the hands of the rider. And then on the shock, we're measuring the shock usually, but we're using the leverage ratio of the bike to actually calculate the rear axle position.
And okay.
So what we do is we look at the vertical displacement of the front and rear axles together, and we look at compression speeds and we look at rebound speeds. and we're quantifying how balanced the bike is based on just isolating the vertical motion of the front and rear axle. And we do that in a unique way where we put everything on a scatter plot and calculate these best fit lines based on every compression or rebound stroke for the front and rear. And when you get those lines to line up, you've theoretically got a balanced bike. And that was, you know, that came through hundreds of iterations of, you know, software and testing and, you know, basically many failures until we kind of stumbled on this thing. And it seemed like it was theoretically, we thought, yeah, this quantifies bike balance, but then we didn't really know if it would work. So then we did a bunch of blind testing with all kinds of riders and determined that, yeah, it works actually quite well.
Interesting. So is it that the output of the system or the app is to show how balanced your bike is and then to help you try and work towards a better balance? Is that fair?
Yeah, you want to get the balance, but then you also want to look at the individual kind of front and rear speeds for compression and rebound. And then you want to look at the range of motion. You know, am I getting the full travel? Am I getting half the travel of the bike? You want to know that as well. And then, so, you know, we basically quantify in its most simple form, we basically just quantify how the bike interacts with the earth. It's not really a fork thing. It's not really a rear shock thing. It's a bike thing. And we've quantified the bike. And that's, you know, that we just, before that, we were just collecting lots and lots of data and doing as much analysis on that data as we could, but it didn't get us to where we wanted to be fast. And so we just kept on, you know, chiseling away at it and trying to present the data in different ways until we actually got something that seemed to really work. And so we ended up with an app that gives you literally hundreds of different metrics on the bike with all these graphs and charts and tables. And it's really the way we use the product now is it's like a sixth sense. Like, yeah, you can feel the bike, you can ride the bike, the bike feels comfortable or not. But then once you see the data, you start putting data visualization to how the bike feels. And you kind of use that as a sixth sense to get your bike dialed in. And so we're not going out and saying, hey, do three clicks here or four clicks. You know, we're not telling the rider how to set their bike up. We're just saying, hey, this is how your bike is interacting with the ground. And then you take the data and you hone in your best tune based on understanding this data.
Yeah. So what was the blind testing? What was the process like with that? Talk us through a little bit. Were you changing certain variables and then getting kind of, without telling riders what you've done, getting their verbal feedback on how that change has impacted the bike's performance?
Yeah. So we just, I had a couple of, you know, really fast enduro pros in my, you know, my neighborhood here that we would go out and do some shuttle runs. And the first thing was, yeah, let's just get a baseline. And the idea was that I'm going to make changes to your bike. I'm not going to tell you what I changed. You just tell me if you'd like the change or not. And that was it. And so the first rider, we took him up there and his name was Tyler. And he had a Yeti SB55. It's 29er. Anyway, I just saw that his rebound was, you know, super slow. The bike was set up pretty stiff and really slow. And so I started opening up his rebound on his fork quite a bit. He went from, like, you know, I want to say 1100 millimeters a second of rebound. We got him up to like 2500. So we like almost tripled the speed of his front fork rebound. And the first couple clicks, he was like, yeah, it feels better, you know, but I can't say it's that much better, but in reality, the data didn't change that much. And then, I said, okay, well, I'm going to open this thing up. And, you know, it got us like three quarters of the way there. But then his eyes were like wide at that next run. And he just said, I don't know what you did, but it's freaking amazing. And I was like, okay, well, we still have some more room to grow. And, got his fork pretty settled. And then ended up opening up his shock all the way, but it was still way too slow. But it's, you know, I'd say we got his bike like, I don't know, 70% of its potential based on what I saw in the data. And then he just said, you know, having that the bike feel like that, it transformed the way he rode the bike, because the way he would descend is he would look for things to bank his bike off because it wouldn't turn. He didn't have traction. And so his bike was packing and it was just doing all kinds of stuff. And so he, you know, he's an amazing rider, but yeah, he was looking for, you know, bases of trees and rocks and stuff to turn the bike. And he said, now I turn the bike and I just look at, you know, far ahead. So I'm way more prepared for what's coming at me versus trying to get my bike to turn. So he went from playing, you know, pinball on the, down the mountain to actually, you know, taking his eyes and looking more forward. And he just ended up being a lot faster.
Yeah. So it's about helping you get the speed of the system working, but then also the front and rear balance, I guess, because if the, like if one element is kind of out overpowering the other, the geometry of the bike's going to be all over the shop and affecting how the bike feels and the grip. Is that fair?
Yes, for sure. And I, you know, I'd say a lot of people, you know, they set their bike up. So if they hear their suspension working, they think it's doing something, but it may be doing something quite negative for them. And so I see a lot of people at the races with, you know, suspension that's just way too clamped down. And, you know, how are they supposed to know? It's not like, you know, there's anybody to help guide them to what they're supposed to be doing. So.
Yeah. I was going to ask, from all of the data that you've seen, do you see common issues in people's setup?
Yeah, I see a lot. Well, so, I would say if you're like a fast female rider, you know, you're light and you're fast, then I would say, you know, I've seen a lot of bikes that are just way overdamped for them. And the problem I see is that in order to get the rebound speed, you kind of need to run a lot more preload so that the spring can compress, but then they're not getting much travel out of the bike. Mm-hmm. So it's double-edged sword. Like, you know, yeah, you're not going to get much travel, but you're going to get the rebound speed. And if you want to get more travel, then you may end up losing out. So, you know, like Ray Morrison was one of the first females that we worked with, and she's a enduro racer for Giant on the Live racing team. And her husband, Jesse, bought a system from us at North Star and started, you know, tuning her suspension. And, you know, he just said it's transformed her bike. They ended up lightening the tune a lot. And he says, you know, he basically said, I can't ride the bike. It's too, you know, crazy fast for me. But for her, it's like, everything's lined up and it's perfect. And she's got a lot of confidence on the bike. And, you know, she won every stage at the Rotorua Enduro this year. So it must be working for her. So,
yeah, that's good to hear. So you've gone then, you've got your prototype system, you've had input from Greg, you've then got this front and rear thing going on. Got some really good data with riders, starting to get some good confidence, I guess, that you can make this thing work, and B, that when it works, it gives good data and it helps people set their bikes up better. But there's a big leap from prototype to then having a business and a production solution. How do you go from prototype to where you are today? And like, how do you raise the cash for that?
Yeah. So So there's, you know, back in my triathlon days, I ended up meeting this guy, Eric, who's a, you know, good friend of mine, and he, you know, he's a venture capitalist. And so I was able to raise some money from him and some other, you know, kind of high net worth investors. We didn't raise much money, but we raised about, you know, $350,000. And that was tranched over a couple of, probably the last couple of years. Our first investment was probably $150,000. I think that's, it might have been 100,000. No, it was 150. Yeah. So yeah, that was our first tranche. We spent, you know, for the first year, we didn't take salaries at all. And so we just put all that money into R&D. And I would say the process was really, I didn't come out with like this huge product vision roadmap. It was really, let's test, let's fail, let's fix. And we just did that every week. And so after I met with Greg in that early on, just after we incorporated, we ended up signing him on as an advisor to the company. You can actually think of him as one of our founders. He's, you know, and he, you know, just having him on with us, it just opened up a million doors because everybody likes Greg. It doesn't matter if it's competitors or anybody in the industry. They just, he's a great guy to work with. And so that just opened up a ton of doors for us. So that was probably our smartest move, getting him to work with us. And you know, that, yeah, that was a, it changed the, you know, the direction of the company quite a bit in a very positive way. So then after that, you know, we just worked our butts off to get this front and rear thing working. I met Greg and Syndicate team at Windrock, I think it was 2018. And I just remember it was the first time we had that many systems in this, in a single location. And, you know, things went off the rails pretty quick. Like, you know, like Greg's app was connected to one of his fork sensors, and then it was on like Loris's rear sensor. So when he got to the top of the mountain, he couldn't record. It was just like all these things came out of the woodwork. Our velocity accuracy was really not great. And so I say that, you know, even though it was a huge failure in terms of kind of a product, you know, kind of showing the potential of the product, it was, I'd say that was a win, but like just so many things failed. It was just like, oh man, we got a lot of work to do. So then after that, we just spent all of our time, you know, focusing on repeatability and accuracy. And so we rented some dyno time from a company down in Southern California, and just, we wanted to make sure that we were getting accurate velocity, you know, measurements. And from there, that just required, you know, us pulling out our textbooks from college and, you know, looking up a lot of DSP algorithms and that kind of thing to, you know, get the data to look really, really good. And so that was, you know, that was probably 6 months of just fixing all the problems that we found at Windrock. And then, I don't know, after probably 2 years, we just kind of took a pause one day and just said, hey, you know, we've got something here. It's not a product that could be used by a consumer, but it's definitely a product that if you were an engineer at a bike company, you'd probably be stoked to have a, you know, have a product like this in your toolbox. And so we ended up, you know, calling, Yeti and Ibis and just saying, hey, look, what do you guys think? We have this system. And, for Yeti, it was just us asking them for a curve for their bike. And they were like, no, we don't give those away. And why do you need it? And then, so once I told them what we were working on, they were like, hey, you know what? That's pretty cool. Why don't we meet up and we'd love to see the product. And so they, I went back out, I went to Colorado and visited them, and they were actually kind enough to put me up in a hotel room because they knew we were, you know, small startup with a very small budget, and they ended up buying a bunch of systems from us. And, you know, they gave us a lot of feedback and it was great. I think Yeti was probably our first customer, and then Ibis, bought a couple systems, and, you know, they ended up kind of massively redesigning their bike. So the Ritmo V2 was, you know, they used our system to kind of dial that thing in, and as well as the HD5 and the new Mojo. So they've been using the system for quite a while now, and they probably got more data than anybody else that I've seen.
Yeah. Awesome. So that was a good encouragement that this thing works, people are interested, let's push on.
Yeah. And like I said, I, you know, with a company like ours, there's just so many things that can fail, whether it's software or the hardware. And so we never really settled in on a hardware design that, you know, we were just like, okay, let's build 25 of these things and see if they work. And sure enough, they would, you know, something would crap out on the system. And so we would, you know, do another spin of a board or change something to be more waterproof or, you know, whatever it is. And we just kind of kept on doing that. And then, you know, if stuff broke in the field, we just say, look, here's a new one. Like, sorry, we're still evolving this thing. But, so we just were in that mode for probably another year, which I kind of recommend, if you can do it that way, just because, you know, once you put a stake in the ground and say, okay, we're going to build a crap load of these things, it's pretty risky. I mean, you're putting a lot of capital into something that could fail. And, you know, and we don't have, it's not like we have had the budget to do, you know, build a bunch of ovens and, you know, shake and bake our hardware to the point where, you know, you would if you were a really big company. We just don't have that kind of budget. So it's more like just iterate, fail, and improve the product, you know, week after week.
Yeah. But you've moved on now and you've kind of, I guess, bitten the bullet, decided that you've got something that is customer worthy effectively, and you've got your production system available. Yeah. What's it like? How is it different from the prototype stuff?
You know, the fork sensor that we've designed is still pretty much the same, but it's a lot more waterproof. We ended up putting in, you know, some O-rings to seal the housings. I've got sheet metal being bent in Taiwan. I've got plastic 3D parts. We're still doing 3D printing on the parts. You know, we're still not even ready to bite off on a mold yet. So I'd say we're still kind of scrappy, but yeah, it's just gotten a lot more waterproof, but that original design has pretty much held intact. There's not much difference between that original design and now. A while back, we ended up changing the processors. We got rid of that TI thing and ended up going to Nordic, which just gave us a much better tool set to design with on the software. So the circuit board changed its shape a little bit, but for the most part, it's the same exact thing that we had. And on the sensors themselves, we were using AIM for a while, but ended up, they just didn't last. They just didn't have the quality that we needed. And so we ended up picking up this other brand that has been, you know, much better for us. So we've got, you know, what I consider our pro system, which is really an expensive position sensor for the fork and one for the shock. And then our expert system uses our fork tracer design and a position sensor for the shock. And we've got this little wireless handlebar button that you can use to drop pins while you're riding. So if something doesn't feel right, you can just push that button and then look at your data and zoom into that pin to see what was happening, to see if your suspension was bottomed out or packing or something, you know, just to see what was going on.
Okay. So that's not like a stop start button. It's a something interesting button that I want to go back and look at.
Yeah. It's a put a needle in the haystack button. So, you know, once you have all this data, it's really hard to go back to a certain event. It can be done because we have GPS tracks and you can kind of figure out, oh, I was about here. But you know, if you got a pin, it's already there in the data. You just zoom into it and see what was going on. And then we also use those pins to isolate segments of trail that are interesting. So let's say you're on a motocross bike and you want to look at just the whoop section. You could drop a pin before the whoop section and then after, and then you can go in the data and say, okay, calculate all the data in the app just between those two pins. So you can do that on a downhill run or certain sections of a trail, that kind of thing.
Okay. And how easy is it to fit to your bike? Is it a 5-minute job or an hour's work or a day pulling your hair out? Like how does it fit?
You know, it depends. Some bikes are really easy. Some are terrible. So like I've got an Ibis, you know, Ritmo V2 and it's pretty easy. I could have a system on there in probably 10 minutes, but like an Evo following, for example, like the shock is, you know, embedded way in the frame. It's terrible. You know, if you got a coil shock, it's probably a little bit easier, but if you're on an air shock, so it just depends on the bike and the shock. Like Greg's V10 is, you know, with that shock way in the belly of the bike, it's impossible to get a sensor in there. So we actually measure his top rotating link. We calculate the displacement of the angle of that rotating link and calculate the rear axle position. So some of the stuff we work with the manufacturers to get specific you know, leverage curves for different parts of the bike that are easier to access.
Yeah. And how do you imagine people using the system then? Do you think you'll see people owning one or borrowing one, or and will people kind of keep it on all the time or just run it for doing setup stuff or maybe use it during practice days at a race? What have you got a feel for how you think people will use it?
Yeah. So I think if you're racing, like everybody should, you know, whether it's our system or somebody else's, like you should be getting data on your bike and you should be recording yourself on your bike on different trails and, you know what your bike feels like on different conditions. So yeah, I think that's, That's like a, if you got a torque wrench, you should have a data system for your bike if you're racing. If you're like a, you know, a hardcore enthusiast like me, like, yeah, I think it's cool to have this thing on your bike. I don't recommend keeping it on there full time. But it is good to get your bike set up. And if you spent, you know, $5,000 to $10,000 on a bike, like whether you rent one of our systems or buy one, like you should use some data to actually get your bike set up correctly. So yeah, I'd say our big customers now are suspension tuners, racers, both on World Cup and Enduro. And, you know, I'd say we're getting a lot of early adopter kind of, you know, folks like myself that are, you know, just curious and technical about their bike and they want to get their bike set up. You know, they paid for the bike, they might as well, you know, develop it to its potential, you know. So that's where our system comes in. I think, you know, where this gets interesting is when we massively cost reduce the system to where it can be OEM'd on a bike, for example. Well, now you've got a system that just is on the bike. There's a lot more data that we can collect that are more fun facts about the bike. Like, hey, what was my angle on that tabletop? Or what was my lean angle on that corner? And how much G-force did I pull in that corner? So if you're trying to actually get fast, wouldn't it be nice to be able to compare your specific data to somebody else and see where they're making up time on you? But like, hey, how hard are they pushing their bike? And you can see that. I mean, we collect all that data. So it's pretty, you know, beyond just setup, I think there's it's a learning tool to help you get faster as well.
Yeah. So is that where you see it all going then, kind of eventually reducing in size and cost to the point where it's integrated into the bikes?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's with any technology. It starts out with something, you know, bigger and bulkier and just gets, you know, reduced to the point where it's, you don't even see it.
Yeah. That would be pretty wild, but I can imagine that being a little while off yet.
Yeah. It's not as far off as you think. But yeah, it's, you know, we've been looking at all kinds of sensors that are much, you know, cheaper and smaller in size to measure different parts of the bike. So yeah, we're starting out with, you know, these kind of expensive position sensors, but there's definitely some things we're working on that are will make it, you know, cheaper down the line and potentially easier to OEM it on a bike.
Yeah, good stuff. So what kind of teams have you got using the system? What's the feedback been like from people?
So trying to think. So Greg has been using it since day one, and you know, I've just been working with him for gosh, almost 3 years now. We've got Scott, the Scott Downhill team bought a system from us, and so they've had some limited testing with it with the Corona, but I know that they're doing some more testing now. I saw a couple of Instagram posts. Mondraker, Lori Greenland's using it, so I know that Mark Sternlin and Lori have been getting a lot of time on the system. I think they had a failure on one of our one of the fork sensors, and that's where we discovered a moisture problem. So you know, in the UK, there's a lot of rain. Go figure.
Yeah.
So those guys. Trying to think else. Tony Seagrave just bought a system. I think Greg made an introduction there, so she'll be using that this year as well. So there's a few. I think we got seven teams now. So on the World Cup side,
amazing. And you say you've got EWS riders using it as well.
Cody Kelly, we did some testing with him at North Star last year. He's got a system. Brian Lopes he's been working with us since the early days as well. So he's got a system on his bike. But he's not really EWS. Ray Morrison, I know, is on the she's got a system with her husband Jesse, so they've been using it quite a bit. We haven't we probably focused more on downhill with, you know, having Greg on the team, you know, our team. So
yeah. That's a really good uptake in a product from quite, you know, yeah, early days, really.
Yeah. And what, you know, what's crazy is we've got like all the major bike companies using our stuff for their development now. So it's, we've got a lot of customers that are in the industry using our stuff. You know, on the suspension side as well, we've got customers from, you know, pretty much everybody except for RockShox. So, yeah, it's been great.
Awesome. Yeah. So you're not regretting starting this little side project then?
No, it was, you know, I'm glad we did it. And, you know, I truly think it was something that, you know, if I didn't do it, somebody else was going to make it happen. So, you know, we knew how to build the system and, you know, execute on it. It wasn't easy. You know, I'd say it was actually quite hard to build it, but, no, I guess somebody could probably copy it pretty quick now that, you know, we've kind of shown that it can be done, but we got a pretty good patent portfolio as well. So.
Yeah. I was going to say, how do you go about protecting it? Is it all in patent side of things, the IP?
Yeah. I mean, there's, you can do some stuff. We've got a pretty interesting patent just on the system from a control system perspective. So that's kind of, you know, the app working in conjunction with the hardware. And it's kind of hard to get software only patents these days. Cause you know, and plus a lot of that stuff can be designed around anyway, but we've got a patent on our fork sensor, the way that works, where there's some unique design there, and as well as some other sensors that we're working on in the future as well.
Exciting stuff. Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing what else comes from you guys in the future and having a play with the system soon, hopefully.
Yeah, for sure. You'll be getting one.
So yeah, what advice would you give people then if they were in a position you were in 4 or so years ago, looking out the window at work, wishing they were somewhere else? Like what would you say to them?
Well, don't ever do anything for the money. It will follow if you do a good job, but like taking the action and actually doing something is way more important than the idea. And I'd say 99 times out of 100, what you end up with is not going to be the original idea that you started with. So no matter how great you think your initial idea is, just be flexible, because somebody's going to come in and like Greg and just, you know, crap all over it and tell you it's not worth anything. And then you're going to have to, you know, put in some more heavy lifting. And like I said, if you aren't passionate about what you're doing, like there will be hard times, and you know, you've got to just push through that stuff. And this is what keeps everybody on the couch, because they don't want to deal with failure. They don't want to be told their product's crap. You know, they just, yeah. So I think the spoils go to anybody who can actually just do something. You just got to, you know, actually do it. Like, don't talk about it, just get it done. And then I would say, you know, what was successful for us, and it was more of, you know, my working style with, you know, Mike and Randy, is just iterate. And, you know, not everything you build is going to be perfect, but you've just got to try it and test it and fail, and just not be bummed when it fails, because, yeah, that's just part of the process. So.
Yeah. Have there ever been points where you've been tempted to give up on this one?
Well, I mean, launching on the eve of a pandemic was not recommended, but yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, I just think whenever we needed a break, we got it. So I think you just got to last. I think there was probably people out there that counted us out a long time ago, and you know, we've pushed way beyond what they thought we could do. So.
Awesome. Yeah. It's good to see it out there, and yeah. And great to hear that teams and companies are getting on board and using it and getting good stuff from it. So it's a great place to be.
Yeah, it's cool. Like we did some testing with the Trek downhill team, and I know that they, you know, they bought one system, just kind of wanted to look at it. And I went down there and helped them, you know, set it up on their bike down in Southern California. And, you know, after that, they just said, man, we really like this, the usability. You know, we can actually coordinate now between our, you know, product management and engineering and race, and the data is so portable that, you know, they can send data back to the factory, you know, even doesn't matter where they are, they can all collaborate on it together. So that never happened for them before. So
yeah, it's getting more Formula One by the day. Great stuff.
Yeah.
I like it. Cool. Nice one. We're getting close to the end of our time, but we've got our four questions that we've asked pretty much everyone. So we'll just hit those real quickly before we finish up. The first one of those, if our listeners had £150, which is about $190 at the minute, I think, to improve their performance on a bike, what would you recommend that they look to spend it on?
Jeez. Well, with free, you can just get Strava and improve your fitness and your times on the trail. So that's free. You know, if you could rent one of our systems and work with somebody that could help you, you know, dial your bike in, that'd be money well spent. I would say, you know, if you don't have the money to buy a system, just rent one and work with somebody that can help you interpret the data and, you know, get the best of your bike. Because, you know, if you spend all this money on the bike and you're leaving a lot of it on the table, that's kind of a shame.
Yeah, it's amazing how many people have got very expensive bikes set up incredibly badly.
Well, and they spend all this money on these really nice shocks, you know, Push and EXT. And it's like, hey, you know what? If you're willing to spend $1,000 on a shock, then you need to put the time in to get it set up. Just don't put it on your bike because it's shiny and new. Yeah, it looks great. They're beautiful looking products. But once you dial them in, they're amazing as well. And so, you know, it's more than just, you know, having that thing on your bike. You've got to spend the time to actually get it working. So
yeah, it's worth the effort for sure.
It's definitely worth the effort.
Cool. All right. Second question. If you could wind back the clock and sit down with yourself age 16, what advice would you give him?
Good God. Well, it's funny because when I was 16, I didn't have a plan. I was terrible. I was a terrible high school student. I didn't go to college right out of high school. I ended up going in construction and just, you know, kind of went through a phase where I really didn't have a lot of fun in my life. And I ended up, you know, one of my customers saw potential in me that I didn't see in myself and basically forced me to go back to college. And they gave me, you know, the resources to basically go back to college. So,
wow.
I would say, you know, if I could go back and say, look, do better in school. Like, there's no excuse just to waste all your time goofing off. You should, you know, put some effort. But on the flip side, like, you know, just keep being that nice person, and you never know. You know, you may get a break. But I wouldn't say that. Yeah. That is not a strategy. So, you know, what happened for me was, you know, that was just, you know, blind luck. So I don't know. I'd say probably just, you know, buckle down and do the work. There's no free ride in this world.
That's very true.
Don't waste your potential. The time goes by way faster than you think it's going to go. So,
yeah, good advice. Third question. If you could have a coaching session from any rider, past or present, who would it be and what would you want to learn from them?
Yeah, I tell you what, I would love a coaching session from Greg. I was able to ride with him once in Santa Cruz when we first, after we first met. And the way he corners a bike is something to behold. Like, he does this technique where he puts so much energy into the rear wheel that by the time he exits the corner, he's doing a full manual out of the corner. And I, you know, trying to keep up with him on that ride, I damn near rolled my tires off my bike. I had to stop and put air in the, you know, I had like 22 in front and rear, and it was just not enough. I had to put a lot more, and I just couldn't even keep him in sight. Not even close. And I was riding way more than I could, you know, way beyond my comfort level, but I'll never forget the way he corners his bike. It's just, yeah. If when you see it live and in person, it's bizarre. So yeah.
Next level. Yeah. Fair play. He's a pretty winning rider, that lad. So not going to argue with that for sure. And then the last question, what do you do every day that you feel benefits you?
You know, I try to get on my, you know, on my bike as much as I can. You know, I work from home, so I get to see my kids every day. So I get a lot of benefits. Just, you know, this coronavirus has been terrible for their education, but Just being able to interact and see them, you know, be close to my family is, you know, that's been pretty special. But in terms of, yeah, benefit, like, yeah, I'd say, you know, going back to that first question of just, you know, just keep moving forward. You're never done. So just, you've just got to keep pushing forward. If you've got a company or you got a product, and just strive to make it better, and, you know, good things will come from that.
Nice one. That's a lovely place to finish. If people want to find out a bit more about what you're up to, where's the best place for them to have a look?
I'd say just go to our website. It's just motioninstruments.com. We've got a, you know, we've got some decent content on our blog. We've got a YouTube page just on some other aspects of our products. So we've got a deep dive video up there. We've got some other videos on how to mount the sensors to, you know, different bikes and shocks and stuff like that. But I would say, yeah, just peruse our website. There's a lot of good information on there.
Okay, good stuff. Yeah, we'll put links in the show notes to your website and to the YouTube so people can find that and have a look.
Yep.
Nice one. Well, thanks, Rob. It's been super interesting chatting. I wish you all the best, and yeah, look forward to seeing many motion instrument systems out there in the real world and having a go with one myself.
Well, I can't wait to get your feedback on it. So that's awesome. Thank you.
Awesome. Cool. Cheers, Rob.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. That's it for this episode with Rob. I hope you enjoyed listening. A massive thanks to Leia and Abbey Bike Tools for supporting this episode. This podcast would no longer exist without the support of the awesome brands and the listeners who help me keep this thing going. Don't forget to head over to layout.com and check out their awesome range of products. And if you want to be in with a chance of winning a pair of their new Aaron Chase signature shoes, then head to layout.com/ACshoe and get entered before the end of July. Also, check out the lovely range of precision tools that Abbey has to offer by heading to abbeybiketools.com, and definitely make sure you check out their complete toolbox options, because they are incredible. If you really want the best toolbox for looking after your bike, then these are the ones. All the links that you need are in the show notes for this episode over on downtimepodcast.com. Don't forget to check out all the new t-shirts over at downtimepodcast.com/shop, where you can pick yourself up some new threads and help support the podcast at the same time. We haven't had any fresh new reviews of the show for a while, so if you've got a couple of minutes, then I'd love to hear your thoughts. It really does help other people find the podcast. You can review us on most of the major podcast players. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss an episode, and also please keep on spreading the word, and you can do that by telling your friends or by sharing our episodes in whatever way works best for you, social media, email, whatever it is. The more people that listen, the easier it gets for me to keep this thing going. So spreading the word really helps make sure this podcast stays on air. All right, we've got another awesome episode coming up soon, but until then, look after each other, and if it's okay to do so, then get out and ride.